Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we visit with Patty Lowe. I'll tell you what, I think some of the most inspiring people are those whose work often is outside the spotlight, but whose commitment and tireless labor benefit all of us. And I think it's really always a treat to learn more about who those people are. And Patty's wonderful book, Native People of Wisconsin, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society, helps us along that task. She's a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication, which is also my home department. Patty, great to have you.
Nice to be here, Larry.
And an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. And, you know, I think we talked when this book first came out.
That was about 12 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked since then.
Well, I've had a couple of books, some other books, and I do all my research for them at the same time. So, you know, lest you think I publish a book every 6 months or so, this is this book, the adult version of this that came out a year ago, and Seventh Generation Earth Ethics, which is a collection of biographies of Native environmentalists,
we
came out this
that.
Year.
Yeah,
so.
We talked about that on the show. Well, this is a wonderful book, and you have some. I mean, it's just not a reprint.
No. There's probably about 20% new material throughout on all the Indian communities. But it also has two new chapters, one on the Brothertown Indians, who are a tribe that many Wisconsinites might not know about because they're the only non-federally recognized tribe in the state, and one on urban Indians, which corrects a mistake I knew almost immediately when I published my first book. I didn't have a section on urban Indians, and really, 60% of Native people live in urban areas, so it was really an oversight that I was really happy to correct with this edition.
I think that would be surprising to many people to know that two-thirds of Indians live in cities. And is life different for that group as you...
I think it is. I think Native people in urban areas tend to fight invisibility because they represent a small fraction of the general population. They're particularly challenged because the social services that would be available to them if they lived on their reservations are not available to them. Or if they do, they look a little bit different and they're more pan-Indian in nature. So being an urban Indian presents a whole set of challenges.
Which we can talk about with Patty Lowe, but we certainly are looking forward to what questions you have. How familiar are you with the Native peoples of Wisconsin? Do you feel like you know them as a vibrant living community or just part of the state's history? Maybe you're a Native. Would love to hear from you. What would you like the rest of us to know about your culture and experience? Give us a call. Native or not, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. This is the Native history of Wisconsin, very rich and complex. I think you've done a good job, and this book, by the way, is aimed at youth.
Fourth and fifth graders.
Done a wonderful job. Maybe tell us about how your book is organized and what it includes.
Well, it was intended to be a resource for Act 31. And some of your listeners may know that this is the educational mandate that came to us in the early 90s, which was really a reaction to some of the boat landing violence of the late 1980s over Ojibwe treaty rights, spearfishing in particular. And the legislature passed this act that requires the teaching of Wisconsin Indian history, treaty rights, sovereignty a couple of times in the K-12 experience, and also requires that teachers who want to be certified to teach in Wisconsin have proficiency in that topic. So there was very little out there at the time of that passage, and I had written Indian Nations of Wisconsin, which was aimed at an adult audience, mm-hmm. but which we found was being embraced by teachers who were looking for resources to help meet the letter and spirit of this mandate. And they were asking, you know, where's the kid literature on this? You know, are there textbooks? And there really weren't any. And so that's why this book was written. It's organized by tribe. One of the things that we see in Native textbooks is, well, first of all, there aren't many out there.
Right.
And those that are really kind of a one-size-fits-all one-size-fits-all approach, and usually are written about U.S. policy and how it affects Indians in general.
Yeah,
are 567 federally recognized tribes in the country, and each of those tribes has its own language, customs, ceremonies, traditions, and so this book is organized by chapter, with a chapter devoted to each of the 12 Indian nations in Wisconsin and the urban community.
And it can I like the way you've got the chapters set up as well, because you have something called Think About It,
mm-hmm.
in each chapter, and it do give us something to think about right off the bat with that.
Right, and one of the things we try to do is ask children, well, how, now that you've read this chapter, how did the Oneida come to lose so much of their land? Why were the brother town forced to move from place to place? Why did the Ojibwe reserve their treaty rights in the manner they did? And so this is an attempt to help children think critically about the events of Wisconsin history when it comes to Native people.
Well, you know, you mentioned the brother town nation a couple times. How were you able to develop the information for this chapter?
Everything I do starts with oral history, and sometimes that might mean creation stories, because there's mm-hmm. even if the stories are fantastic and you think, well, you know, this is more of a fairy tale than mm-hmm. than actual history, there are always core truths that come out of that, and it also helps an outsider understand, you know, what's important to that tribe, because the world view is embedded in those stories. The Brother Town are an interesting tribe because they're an amalgamation of several tribes, some of whom were wiped out in the 16th and 17th centuries out east. And so they, back in the day, the Christian leaders, mainstream Christian leaders, separated the Native people they had Christianized into what was called praying towns. And so these were Native people whose common language was English. And yeah. after the Revolutionary War, a group of those Christianized Indians representing seven different tribes got together and decided they were wanting to form their own community, which they wanted to live in peace and brotherhood. Mm-hmm. So they named their community Brothertown. And the Oneida, who were then in New York, in what's now upstate New York, gave them a piece of land. But after the Revolution, there was this movement to move all Native people west of the Mississippi River. So the Oneida were losing their land, the Mohicans were losing their land, all these tribes that were living in what we would called New York State yeah. right now, were being pressured to move west. So the Brothertown moved west with the Oneida and the Mohicans, got to Wisconsin, were moved a couple of times once they got to Wisconsin, and in 1838-39, They were very concerned. The Indian Removal Act had been passed in 1830, and they saw a lot of tribes were being relocated to what's today Oklahoma. And they thought the best way to hold on to their land was to accept citizenship. They didn't realize that in accepting citizenship, they were also accepting termination. So they were terminated by an act of Congress in 1839. And even though they continued to act as a government body, and they've kept their traditions, and they've been trying to get reinstated, they spent 30 years trying to go through a Bureau of Indian Affairs policy to help tribes that had been terminated be restored, only to find out that, oops, you're not eligible to use that process because you were terminated by an act of Congress, and it'll take an act of Congress to reinstate you.
Patty Lowe, our guest today. You can join in with your questions and comments as we talk with her about her book, Native People of Wisconsin. Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. And let's turn to Maddie in Waupaca as a question or a comment. Maddie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes, I'm a member of the Oneida Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, and I'm 74 years old. I was born and raised on the reservation, and I do love my fellow tribal members. I tape recorded a number of prominent Oneida elders, like Irene Moore. She was the first woman chairman of the Oneida tribe, and Amos Christian, he was prominent in teaching Oneida language, and Anna John, our nursing home is named after her, and my father, Isaiah Cornelius, and a number of people. And those tape recordings are at the Oneida Cultural Heritage Center on
wonderful.
CD Dell.
Wonderful.
And the thing of it is I find that even among our own people, there is a lack of accurate history knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I realized recently is that a lot of Oneida people think that the people I recorded talked about when they were around 10 or 12 years old, they went away to government boarding school.
Right, right.
And today's Oneida people think that the federal government came in and rounded those kids up and shipped them off to boarding schools far away. And that is not, when you listen to those recordings, that just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was the parents and grandparents of the children who realized how absolutely necessary it was for the children to learn to speak English and to learn how to read and write, because, you know, this new day was coming, and if they didn't know how to do that, we were going to be in trouble.
Maddie,
you
know, you bring up an interesting point, and it's one that is kind of uncomfortable for a lot of Native people. Definitely, there were Indian children who were removed from their families against their will. I have that in my personal history, and I've read affidavits of kidnappings from the St. Mary's boarding school and children placed at the government boarding school in Lac des Flambeaux. But you're absolutely right in that a lot of Native families chose very deliberately to send their children to boarding school because they felt that it was the best. They were giving them an opportunity to learn about this new society that they needed to adapt to. And the experiences, and I think, you know, in Indian country, we like to wrap boarding school around us and, you know, as a blanket of victimhood in some cases, to to say, look at what was done to us. And absolutely, it was a flawed educational policy. It shouldn't have happened. But there is another side to the boarding school experience. And what I find really interesting is some of the major political figures in Native America, John Echohawk with the Native American Rights Fund, and there are many others, went to boarding school and learned were supposed to be tools of assimilation that they used as weapons to fight for sovereignty and treaty rights and land reclamation.
And probably without that education, they might not have been able to do it, or at least taken a lot longer.
Absolutely. And because those boarding schools were pan-Indian, Native people found people from other tribes and were able to compare notes and work together. You know, the National Congress of American Indians is born from that idea that we're stronger together than we are individually.
Patty Lowe, our guest today, talking with her about her book, Native People of Wisconsin. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, having a great time talking with Patty Lowe, professor at the UW-Madison and the Department of Life Sciences Communication. Her book, her revised and new edition of her book, aimed at probably fourth and fifth graders, but you know what? I learned an awful lot. I really enjoyed it myself, as a matter of fact. It's called Native People of Wisconsin, a great new book out by Wisconsin Historical Society.
A fabulous press.
That is a wonderful press.
You know, Larry, I was listening to On Point as I was driving here for this interview, and they were talking about mixed race identity, and I thought it was such a fabulous conversation. And I think a lot of the misunderstanding that mainstream America has about Indians is because there are really two identities. You have the racial ethnic identity, but you also have a political identity. Mm-hmm. And the political identity is the identity that existed before the federal government established roots here. And the act of sitting down and treaty making with those sovereign Indian nations, that's where our rights, our government rights as Native citizens, derive. And so when I wish I had a penny for every person that's asked me, what part American are you? Or what part Indian are you? And I never know what to say, because are they talking about racial ethnic heritage? Well, you know, I could do the math on that. Or are they talking about a political identity? Because I'm 100% a citizen of my Indian nation. And that's where my rights as a Native citizen derive.
We have several questions for you here, Patty, from callers. Anne wondered, she said, I've only known of six tribes in the state. Could you name all of the 12 tribes of the state?
Sure. There are six bands of Ojibwe: the St. Croix, Red Cliff, Lac des Flambeaux, Lac-Couturier, Bad River, and Secaucus or Mole Lake. There's the Forest County Potawatomi, who also have a presence in Milwaukee. There's the Ho-Chunk, on whose ancestral land we sit here in Madison. The Oneida, the Mohican, and the Brothertown. And then this other community in Wisconsin, in urban areas.
So there we have it. And you discuss every one of them.
Right, in the book.
In the book, with some really fascinating information about every one. Caller from Oconomowoc, Bob, wonders, who was the first tribe to settle in Wisconsin?
Well, the Ho-Chunk and Menominee stories go way back, and they are absolutely indigenous to this area. And after that, the Sauk and the Fox were here, the Kickapoo, Maskoutin. There were other tribes that are no longer in Wisconsin. The Ojibwe and Potawatomi stories say they're here in the Upper Great Lakes region. There was a flood. They moved east. There was a prophecy. They were told to come back to their original homes to look for the food that grows on water. And I think, and in that prophecy is really interesting, and this is where I'm devoting some of my research today and trying to figure out how I can tell the story without making it appear that I'm trying to verify or justify Native stories with using, you know, mainstream historical methods. But according to the Ojibwe prophecies, there was a crisis that happened in the East, and we were told we needed to go back to our original homes or we would be destroyed. And there would be this sign, a Miga shell in the sky, that would lead us back to through seven stopping places to our original homes. And I think the crisis was the introduction of European diseases through the Vikings, you know, the Norse colonists,
yeah.
Because Native people are mentioned in some of those early Icelandic sagas.
Yeah.
And I think the Miga shell in the sky was the Crab Nebula, the supernova exploding in the year 1054. So that's when I think the Ojibwe started their migration back, and the Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Odawa were with them. So I think it way precedes the 17th century.
1492.
Yeah, right.
There we go. Well, Vivian in Green Bay has a comment. Let's go to Vivian. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. I'm uncomfortable with what I perceive as a disinterest in Indian history. I was an elementary school library secretary at King Elementary in Green Bay, which is on the Oneida Reservation.
Right.
We had a good representation of Oneida children, some Menominee as well. And at the time, PBS was airing We Shall Remain, which was absolutely an incredible five-part program, starting with Massasoit. Mm-hmm. Another episode covered the Cherokee removal. A final episode covered Geronimo. Not specifically relevant to Wisconsin tribes, but I took advantage of that, promoted that series. We had a good collection of books on Native Americans in Wisconsin, and put those all out for display during an open house. Parents, teachers, students, everyone could see what we had to offer, and they could see the displays I'd made for We Shall Remain, telling them it was coming. Not many books went out.
Mm-hmm.
No conversation was generated. And I'm thinking, we have these things. Use them, please. It just blew me away. I thought there'd be a lot more interest. Mm-hmm. It was that, and We Shall Remain is just one of my favorite programs. I think it's so well done. But why is there that disinterest?
Boy, I'm not sure how to answer that, but I will say that I actually worked with WGBH in Boston, the entity that produced We Shall Remain, and wrote the library event kit. I don't know whether you use that or not, but our approach was, yes, these five episodes were tribal specific, but some of the themes of relocation, reservation making, treaty rights, are themes that are pretty universal throughout Indian country. And the idea was to use that documentary as a springboard for local discussions. And it sounds like you did all the right things. And I, you know, I'm just so sorry that you didn't get the response that you were hoping for. You know, it's disappointing to hear.
Yeah. And hopefully, do you have elsewhere? Do you know if conversations developed around that series?
Well, there was a lot of conversations here in Madison, actually,
yeah.
And there were libraries that were planning events, and I know I was part of quite a few of them. Janice Rice, who is a Ho-Chunk librarian who just recently retired from college library, was really instrumental in organizing a lot of events and getting Ho-Chunk people here. But it seemed that those sessions were pretty well attended, actually. So, who knows? There could have been so many reasons why people in your area didn't didn't participate, you know, ranging from things that were beyond your control, like an elder may have passed that mm-hmm. week, and there were, you know, funeral services and that kind of thing. So it's really mm-hmm. difficult to say why it didn't work in your particular area.
But thank you so much, Vivian, for your work, and I know you're retired. I guess you're retired now, but appreciate your comments today about the series. By the way,
it was a wonderful series, and you can still, if you go to pbs.org and search We Shall Remain, there's a whole page, well, a really robust website that has lots of links to shorter, you know, 2-3 minute documentaries, historical resources, bibliographies, extra interviews. It's really a wonderful website and still very relevant.
And as long as, you know, we're talking about videos and such, you're working right now, as a matter of fact, on another program relating to D-Day and Native Americans.
I'm helping a French filmmaking company that is looking at the service of Native American veterans in France during World War II. And the air date is D-Day. And it comes out of a real sincere desire, I think, on the part of this company to really highlight the contributions of Native American soldiers in fighting for French freedom. And so if anybody's listening out there and knows of a World War II Native American veteran in Wisconsin who served in France during World War II, boy, please contact me because I'm trying to help identify interview subjects for this company.
There we go. And please do that. And by the way, we have a link to Patty's book and how to contact her on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So that's easy enough to do.
Larry, can I give another plug for a wonderful resource that just happened, just came out last week? It's
sure.
WisconsinAct31.org. WisconsinAct31.org that came out of the UW School of Education. I believe Wisconsin Public Broadcasting is a partner. There are lots of other really great partners, Extension. And it's a resource for the general public, but also teachers who are trying to learn more and accurate information about Native Americans in Wisconsin that they can share with their students.
Ray and Rhinelander has a question. Hi, Ray. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your guest to help to educate people on more accuracies about the past, the present, and the possible future. I have an interesting viewpoint here. I was at a powwow about 3 years ago, and there was a couple Kickapooins mixed in with some other tribes out west and that came to this powwow, and I was talking to this young man about, do you know that your tribe originally came from Wisconsin? He looked at me kind of surprised. He said he had heard about that, but, you know, he had mixed feelings I could tell about, so I didn't push the issue.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is, what happened to the majority of the Kickapoo, the Sauk, and the Fox? I know the Sioux were very aggressive on coming into this part because of the rice. Wild rice.
Right.
In fact, the last battle that took place with the Sioux was south of Mole Lake by Post
right.
Lake there.
Right.
That's well documented. So, and of course, Abraham Lincoln was part of the, he was a private in the army that pushed the Black Hawk and his
yep.
group through that area. So anyways, there's a lot of stuff attached. So what happened to the Sauk, the Fox, and the Kickapoo? I know some of them were removed out west, but is there any elders or anybody alive? I mean, what's
mm-hmm.
going on with that?
What a great question. And it's obvious you know your history because the Kickapoo and the Sauk and Fox were removed from Wisconsin. And you really have to go back to the 1820s and the lead mining that was happening in southwestern Wisconsin. It was not too long after America had fought the War of 1812 against the British. There was still some concern about how secure the United States was. The Louisiana Purchase had just happened, and in that purchase, there was this rich lead mining area of southwestern Wisconsin. And so the United States government was very, very interested in acquiring that district and getting lead miners in there, primarily to produce ammunition. And the Sauk, the Fox, the Ho-Chunk, you see the pressure on them to sign treaties. There was a lot of skullduggery involved with those that treaty making. And the idea was to push them out. If you want some really interesting reading, read some of the history of our Governor Dodge, who was actually the person that introduced slaves to Wisconsin. He came up from Missouri, and he did some pretty strong-handed tactics to intimidate the Ho-Chunk. And, of course, the Sauk and Fox were pressured into signing a treaty. Half the tribe left with Keokuk, the peace chief. Some sided with Black Hawk, and we know, you know, how that ended. But the Kickapoo were removed during that period of time. They were aligned with the Sauk and Fox. And one of the things that's really interesting is when the Kickapoo were moved west, some of them were able to escape, I believe, in Nebraska, in present-day Nebraska, and wound up finding refuge in Mexico, and show up at the Alamo fighting with Santa Anna against the Americans at the Alamo.
Oh my God.
And right now the Kickapoo have, you know, they have a presence on both sides of the border in the United States and in Mexico.
Well, thank you very much for your comments. And you mentioned Mexico. Let's go north to Canada here, because we had an email question from Steve in Madison wondering, as Canada has a large and long marginalized Native population, did you find or use any Canadian models for introducing curriculum into schools?
That's another really good question, and I didn't. I was looking at Indigenous models primarily that existed within the 12 communities here in Wisconsin. But there are some interesting models, especially when it comes to media. There's a really rich Aboriginal media initiative in Canada. And so, you know, there's some pretty good language videos out there, but their situation with their provincial government is different than ours politically. It's structured differently.
Judith in Grand Marsh has a question. Hi, Judith.
Hello. Thank you so much for Patty's work. Is there some sort of practical way a white person who every time this issue comes up can feel a stone in my heart and never know what to do with that? What can we do besides learning more? But, you know, you're not going to have a license plate or photos on cereal boxes with lost Indian history. So
What can we...
I think a robust discussion, you know, there are cultural events on Indian reservations. You can go online and find a powwow directory, and you absolutely are welcome as a non-Native person to attend those events. That's the whole point of them, to get people together and experience Native culture, but you know, through the individual one-on-one conversations that you have with Native people, you can find out about some of the specific issues in that community and ask them what kind of assistance they need. You know, right now there are a lot of environmental issues, and I think it's safe to say that many of the tribes, if not all of them, feel somewhat under assault, whether it's, mining laws or logging or frac sand mining, and they're different depending on each community. But there are a lot of Native, non-Native coalitions that are forming around those issues. And if you're sincerely interested in helping a particular community, I know that they would be, you know, they would welcome that help.
And thanks for that question. We have an email question from, or actually a call from Richard, who wondered which term is appropriate, Native American, American Indian, something else. I've been saying natives, you've been saying Indian.
Well, I mean, I use the terms interchangeably. If you ask my mother, she hates the word American Indian. You know, I'm not Indian. I'm indigenous to this culture. I'm Native. But you know, the word Native American, Larry, you're Native American.
Yeah.
My father, who is German, is Native American because he was born here in the United States,
exactly,
and that makes
right.
him Native. So that's not quite right. American Indian. You know, I think it's generational. Some people are okay with it. Some people, like in my mother's generation, dislike it. Indigenous is not a word that, you know, comfortably rolls off the tongue. First Nations, which I think is the best term, has been pretty much appropriated by Canadian Indigenous people. And so mm-hmm. when I hear the term First Nations,
I think about
Indigenous people in Canada. So I think if you ask most Native people, they would tell you they prefer their tribal affiliation first. I'm most comfortable with Ojibwe or Anishinaabe, but I realize that, you know, at some point you're going to have to talk about Native Americans in the aggregate. So I think the best thing is just to ask the individual person what they're most comfortable with.
Jim emailed and said, have you ever thought about doing a MOOC for interested adults using your book as a basis?
Oh, Jim, I love that idea. I think I might run with that.
Actually, I think it'd be wonderful and bring people in from all over the world.
Right, right.
On something like that.
Oh, okay. I like
Her
that.
Her eyes lit right
hey,
up.
Yeah, nice. All right.
Oh,
got
to
follow up on that one. That's a great suggestion.
And somebody wondered about why people aren't allowed on reservations other than...
Oh, they absolutely are. You know, and there are sometimes there are places that are off limits to non-tribal members there, and usually those places have some kind of sacred component or are environmentally or ecologically sensitive for some reason, and they don't want the public in. But you know, there are townships that were overlaid and laid out over the existing reservations. So there are county highways and state highways that go through the reservations. I don't know of any reservation that tries to keep people out. And so, you know, you should probably check if you go onto a reservation, maybe stop off at the tribal center and introduce yourself and find out if there are any places that are off limits. But in my experience, you know, anybody is welcome on an Indian reservation.
And you've kind of invited and welcomed them in with your book, I think, as well.
Thank you, Larry.
Native People of Wisconsin, Patty Lowe, the author, again, is going to be available at any bookstore. And if you've got a fourth or a fifth grader, likely there are thousands and thousands of youngsters.
I'm told 18,000 kids use the book.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you, Patty.
You bet.
Patty Lowe, our guest, she, again, professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication. Great to have her come by to talk about her book, Native People of Wisconsin. Well, coming up, we're going to switch gears a bit and talk with you about digital media trends. What's going on out there? I can't keep up with it. Don Stanley can. And he'll be talking with us about it next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.